This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This weekend, activists gathered in Nashua, Keene, Manchester, and elsewhere to call attention to the heroin epidemic and the toll it's taking on families and communities. They called for more services in a state ranked quite low in terms of substance abuse treatment, and they tried to humanize the addicts in their lives. Daughters, sons, parents, colleagues, dear friends. Our guest today knows these stories all too well. Appointed in January by Governor Hassan to head up the state's battle against heroin and opioid addiction, Jack Wozmak, known as the state's drug czar, recently released 22 recommendations that include increasing availability of the overdose reversal drug Narcan to revising guidelines for prescribing opiates. Meanwhile, so far this year, more than 200 Granite Staters have died from drug overdoses, increasing the sense of urgency and frustration on those on the front lines of this fight. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with drug czar Jack Wozmak, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Director Wozmak, thank you for being here. It's good to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the number of deaths are shocking, more than 300 last year. Already more than 200 this year, and the year's not out. Never mind the impact on families, the economy, the community. Who do you blame for this?
Well, I'd say in a way we're all to blame. If you look at the increase in the use of opioid medications over the last 20 years and you plot the percentage increase, which is somewhere between 400 and 600% increase over the last 20 years, and you look at the rate of heroin addiction, the two track each other. And there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind that there's a direct correlation between the use of opioids and the rise in heroin addiction.
Legal opioid-based painkillers.
Correct. When I've interviewed more than a dozen heroin addicts about where they got their start, how they transitioned to heroin. 90% of them talk about having started taking opioids that were simply left over from friends and relatives and elsewhere. They might buy it on the street, but they simply might scoop it out of the medicine cabinet. 90%. So that's pretty shocking in terms of the origin of their heroin use.
Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin said in a recent interview, quote, "The federal government, the FDA, are partners with the pharmaceutical industry in creating this crisis." Pretty harsh. He's saying the three of them are complicit.
Well, there's no question that we are all in this together. And there's no question really that everybody owns up to that. The Centers for Disease Control has said that this is the worst epidemic that we have created in 100 years. The medical community, the AMA, recognizes that the use of opioids, while well-intentioned, seemingly well-reasoned 20 years ago, has simply run amok in terms of the practice getting ahead of the science, which is to say we're using opioids far more than we should for things that we shouldn't be using opioids for. Even the pharmaceutical companies have acknowledged that they overshot the mark. Practice is ahead of the science. We need some reverse education, and we need to rein this back in.
So what is the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry doing about this? Doctors as well. I'll put them in the bag too.
Yeah. Well, listen, this is a society problem. So let me kind of peel this onion away a little bit at a time. drug companies have contributed money to a fund to produce materials that are intended to re-educate physicians on the appropriate use of opioids. And that re-education involves changing the way that physicians interact with their patients, the questions that they ask, trying to get a sense of whether or not a person may be susceptible or have predisposition to addiction, the sorts of stressors in their life, an analysis, a more refined analysis of the pain that the person is experiencing, and using opioids as a last resort for chronic pain rather than a first resort. We've developed this pattern over the last 20 years because we believe that opioids were God's own medicine, the be-all, the end-all for pain. We were going to eliminate pain in everybody's life, seemingly without consequence. And it turns out that we've created quite a monster. And so there is an educational process. It's one of my recommendations, obviously, and we're actually moving forward with a program that we intend to move around the state and expose the 6 to 7,000 physicians and 6 to 7,000 other prescribers to education that encourages them to reexamine the manner in which they practice pain management. Clearly, opioids have a very valuable function in the acute care setting for short-term pain. It is a very effective drug, but it is not as effective in the long term, which is to say, and clinicians differ on what this guideline might be, but there is a growing trend that very few people should ever be on opioids longer than 90 days.
That even sounds like a long time.
It does. It does.
Yeah. And, you know, you said doctors and other professionals, Director Wozmak. Who does that include?
Well, of course, you've got physicians. They're going to be prescribing. But you've got nurse practitioners. They can prescribe. You've got physician's assistants. They can prescribe. You've got dentists. You've got, I think even podiatrists can issue prescriptions for opioids. Veterinarians are a source of these sorts of scheduled narcotics with respect to pain for animals, which of course is a prescription given to a human being, and they go to the pharmacy and they fill it and they take the medications home. And I've heard some stories about veterinarians who have given loaded syringes of narcotics to people so that they can inject their animals with them to relieve the pain. So I'm not suggesting that's misguided, but it puts a lot of ammunition from a narcotic point of view into the hands of a person, and they have this in the home.
What's so interesting is that even though we've been talking about this for a couple of years now at least, and probably longer, I still hear from friends and family that they went to the dentist or they went to the doctor and they still walked out with way more pain meds than they needed. Still.
We have worked very hard to create a generation of physicians who, I'll say, were hell-bent to eradicate pain. In fact, we have created standards at the Joint Commission for accreditation of hospitals and healthcare facilities. We have woven pain response into regulations at the Board of Medicine. We have created a societal expectation that nobody should have to be in pain with the modern drugs that are available. And we have to begin to undo that. We have to change our societal response to pain, and I'll say be a little more participatory in our response to chronic pain. What does that mean? That means that going forward, you may expect, or you should expect, or I certainly hope that you can expect, that a physician will say, maybe we should try Tylenol. Maybe we should try physical therapy. Maybe we should try chiropractic. Maybe you should get more exercise. Maybe you should do a lot of other things before we settle into a response that involves narcotics, which have the potential to be addictive.
Okay, but acupuncture, chiropractic,
acupuncture, mindfulness,
naturopath, all that.
Meditation.
Okay, but
all of those are absolutely clinically proven to be effective.
Right,
there's no
but a
question
lot of them
about
aren't covered
that.
By insurance.
A lot of them are not. And
whereas
so
the pill is.
The pill is. And so one of the conversations that I have begun to have, both with our own Medicaid policies in the state as well as insurance companies in the private sector, is whether there are perverse incentives which would favor a less expensive pill or a more expensive alternative approach to treating somebody's chronic pain. So those are discussions that are underway. They are clearly things we need to look at. This cannot be a response that is simply about the money. We may end up spending more money to treat people with chronic pain going forward than we have in the past. But that is an appropriate thing to do because we have created hundreds of thousands of addicts.
In a moment, I want to ask you how we're helping those addicts, who's responsible for helping them, whether it's the state, whether it's private insurance, Medicaid, individuals, and so forth. Let me also remind our listeners, Jack Wozmak, that they can join us. The number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation, we're talking with Jack Wozmak. He's New Hampshire's Senior Director of Substance Misuse and Behavioral Health, also known as the state's drug czar, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the email address is exchange at nhpr.org. One more question, Director Wozmak, on this whole issue of prescribing and how this has really helped create this crisis that we're in now. The state did come up a few years ago with a prescription drug monitoring program. It's not mandatory. Many people in law enforcement and elsewhere think it should be. What do you think?
I think this is a law that has gone through some evolution. It started out much more constrained in terms of the data that could come from it, how long we could keep the data, who could see the data, what we could do with it.
Data about prescribing
practices.
Data
about prescribing practices.
Who's giving out what.
Right. And effective July 22nd, we did make some modifications to that statute, which allowed more use of it. And the law does require prescribers or dispensers to register. And so there is a statutory requirement that physicians and other prescribers or dispensers register. And there's a requirement that pharmacies report the prescriptions that are filled. And they have to do those reports within 7 days of the date that the prescription is filled. Typically, they do it much sooner than that. So we actually can track a lot of information with respect to who's prescribing. And we can see the prescribers who are accessing the system. They register, and so they're not required to – physicians are not required to access the prescription drug monitoring program at the moment, right, before they issue a script.
To see if somebody's gotten it elsewhere.
To see if somebody has been doctor shopping or –
Okay, that seems like a giant hole.
It potentially could be, but one of the things we are going to do – well, I think two things. We'll probably introduce legislation that makes it mandatory. But we'll also by then have some data to reflect whether or not physicians are willingly, voluntarily using it. And so we'll be able to see how big that gap really is.
All right. Coming up, we will turn to the issue of treatment or the lack thereof. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Jack Wozmak. He's New Hampshire's Senior Director of Substance Misuse and Behavioral Health for the Governor's Office, also known as the state's drug czar. We're talking about the heroin and opioid addiction epidemic here in the Granite State. You can join us, too, with your questions, comments, concerns. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Director Wozmak, here's a Facebook comment from Juliana. Has the tighter regulation of pain clinics led to the heroin epidemic? Should pain clinics be utilized as part of the solution with helping opioid addicts rehabilitate instead of leaving them high and dry by cutting them off if they are noncompliant with stricter regulations, by eventually tapering completely away from opioid-based drugs to something more holistic for pain management? Juliana says the pain clinics and Big Pharma played such a big role in this epidemic. I think they should be part of the solution. Juliana, thank you for the comment. It's an interesting idea.
Well, I'm not sure that I would advocate that a pain clinic, at least a freestanding pain clinic, is the solution. My initiatives have involved conversations with the medical chief medical officers of hospitals with the goal of establishing pain intervention specialists within each medical center so that the prescribers, the primary care, or the docs that are part of the medical centers can get some, I'll say, in-house guidance on the use of opioids or the tapering of people off of chronic opioids onto more effective medications that have a lower addiction potential. I think it's a mistake to take someone who has a primary care doc in a medical facility and then send that person down the road to some detached clinic at the edge of town to get their medical care. As you may sense, I'm not a big fan of those freestanding pain clinics. I think that what we need to do is integrate chronic pain management and the use of opioids into primary care, into the mainstream medical care model, and deal with it at a provider level and provide the resources and the comfort for patients and prescribers as well about the proper use of opioids, the proper timeline and method of tapering somebody off of opioids onto other things, recognizing that you can't leave the patient behind. There are many, many people with valid pain for years, and you can't leave those people behind. They need to have.
Maybe that's why the pain clinics sprung up, is they felt like they were being ignored by the regular medical system.
Sure, there are responses to this crisis which have caused physicians to kind of do all or nothing. They're either going to continue on with what they're doing, or they're never going to issue opioids again. That's not the right response either. We have to still provide care for patients, and that patient, those patients have pain. And so we need to have an interaction with the patient about the pain and to try to fashion a more clinically responsible approach to the chronic pain. That's the purpose of some of the training that we'll be rolling out beginning on November 13th with the Boston University School of Medicine and our partner with Catholic Medical Center. And we'll move that program around. Now, there are critics of that program because it is on the one hand, the educational programs that I'll be moving around the state are funded by the drug companies. That said, the drug companies didn't necessarily do it voluntarily. They did it as a matter of federal regulation by the Food and Drug Administration.
Well, so, getting to Juliana's point, they were part of the problem, so make them part
right.
of the solution.
That's right.
And they are part of the solution. I have a question for you, though, Director Wozmak. You know, we've talked a ton already this hour about, you know, the connection between legal pain drugs and how that really helped create this heroin crisis. The last two stories of addiction that I heard, and these are personal stories from people I know, had to do with young women who were not in chronic pain, who were in a partying type situation. You know, maybe they were drinking, maybe they were smoking pot. Their defenses were down. Someone offered them heroin, and they said, sure, and then the next thing they knew, they were addicted. I've heard that story twice recently.
I've heard it numerous times.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. So that's different from what we're talking about. The person who, you know, breaks their – hurts their back on the job and, you know, needs pain meds. And then, you know, this story that we've heard a lot about, that's the story that's equally disturbing.
Right. You have to understand that it isn't I don't want to vilify opioids as being the cause because it isn't. It is a part of a cause. You have to think of addiction as a bit of a triangle. You have to have a, I'll say, a genetic predisposition to develop an addiction under the right circumstances. The second element or the second leg of that stool is you have to have a drug which is capable of becoming addictive. And then you have to have a third leg of that stool, which basically is some sort of event or stressor or condition or environmental thing that brings all that together and says, okay, I've experimented with this drug. The drug is addictive. I have this predisposition. And that's the magical kind of combination that creates all of this misery. There are many people who take opioids who do not get addicted. There are many people who shoot heroin who could stop tomorrow and not kind of suffer the withdrawal or have the chemical changes in the brain that plague many addicts. So the degree of physiologic addiction varies with a lot of people. That doesn't change the fact that from a behavioral point of view, the behaviors of drug misuse involve taking a drug that, in spite of its negative consequences, you continue to use over and over and over again, and you have that cycle. So it is clearly a behavioral issue, even if there isn't a deep-rooted physical neurological addiction.
Let's take some calls, Director Wozmack. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Juliana, thank you for that Facebook comment. And let's go to Ashley in Alton. Hi, Ashley. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is concerning, as having lost a family member recently to a heroin overdose, having three young children, extremely concerned about this problem our society is facing. I did grow up in Massachusetts where DARE program was a mandatory part of our schooling. None of my children have been exposed to a DARE-type program to educate young children on the dangers of many drugs. Of course, there are many other drugs out there other than just the heroin and opioid problem, but it seems to be a lacking thing. It's on us at home to discuss, you know, the dangers of all these drugs, which is, of course, our job as parents, but there are a lot of children that aren't receiving that information at home, and my husband and I are just so concerned, saying, where are the DARE programs? Where
right.
are the programs brought into the schools, upfront and personal, to these children every week, week in, week out, to educate them, especially in this epidemic that we're facing. We find that slightly concerning.
Well, Ashley, and I'm sorry to hear about your loss. So thank you for
thank
sharing
you.
That with us. Yeah. And so she's hoping for, you know, some backup there. She's delivering the message, but she's saying, let's repeat it again and again.
Right. And I have two major elements of prevention. I have basically three buckets I'm working in: prevention, treatment, and recovery. Half of the prevention mission for me is to stop creating addicts, and to do that through physician education and to decrease the prevalence of opioids flooding the streets and into our bodies. But the other half of the prevention bucket for me is, I'll say, infusing or integrating prevention messaging into school curriculum as early as kindergarten. I think that the moment that kids leave the house and they're paired up with other kids, whether it's kindergarten or elementary school, middle school, high school, all the way through, we need to do a better job at integrating prevention messaging into the curriculum. At the moment, the prevention type messages that we give, and there's a lot of them, are really kind of add-ons. We'll send an EMT into a school. We'll send a school resource officer in. We have addiction people, counselors who can do interventions. We try to identify kids at risk and to deliver service to them.
It's part of a six-week health class in high school, for example. They
yeah.
say it's bad, don't do it.
Right. But there's a stronger model with respect to infusing or integrating prevention into curriculum so that every class you take, and this is going to sound a little discordant, but whether it's math or science or history, obviously wellness is a clear one, home economics, other things. There are models out there where you can introduce prevention messaging into almost every aspect. And what that does is it increases the prevalence of prevention messaging.
What is that messaging, though? What does it sound like? Because, you know, to the average teenager right now, it just sounds like blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and there's probably not enough time to go into the detail of that, but we have to begin to educate children really in terms of these lifelong decisions of everything they take into their body. This is really an extension of wellness. We're all about wellness, losing weight, getting more exercise, watching what we eat, organic foods. This is really a wellness extension. And so the message with respect to prevention could involve weaving statistics about drug use into a math class, right? It could involve history, because there isn't any aspect of history that doesn't involve substance use and its aftermath. A little example, Vietnam War. Heroin was widely used by many military. But you don't, when you take a history course in high school, you don't really read or hear about that and the consequences of it. And so there's a number of ways that in every academic curriculum, we could introduce prevention messaging that touch on and increase people's sensitivities to the use and misuse of substances, and that kind of sits on the back of empowerment, education, awareness. A lot of children come from dysfunctional homes. A lot of children, they go to school. We know that they've got problems at home. We know that there are drug users at home. We know that people may just drink too much at home. Bad modeling for kids. We need to be able to get as many messages as possible to children. Not that they're going to confront their parents and this and that and the other thing, but they need to be stronger. They need to be able to see that there are other ways to grow up. We need to make them stronger about the choices they make and to give them the skills that they need to say no and to make the right decisions about all health matters.
Ashley talks about little kids. So you're saying maybe we need to start this messaging earlier than, you know, eighth or ninth grade.
Oh, clearly, in my view.
Is that what happens now? When does it start now?
In my view, it doesn't start early enough. We do a youth risk behavior survey in the high school. There are some prevention efforts that I think happen around middle school. But, you know, by then, every kid has talked to 100 other kids, and many of them already have preconceived notions in their head. They've already shared a decade outside the house with other school kids about the experiences that they have at home. You know, I've interviewed 8 or 9 child intake workers over at Division of Youth and Family Services, and they're interviewing kindergarten kids.
Wow.
Who are talking to them about their mother shooting heroin, people coming going from the house, there's no age that's too young. Once your child is old enough to leave the home and go into any educational setting, whether it's kindergarten or someplace else, to get that message out there.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for calling in. And again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Up next is Karen. Hi, Karen, go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, it's actually Karen.
Okay.
I'm a psychologist, and I have a private practice in North Conway, and I've been treating addicts for 35 years. One of my concerns is that the treatment model that has been used for 35 years over and over and over again and has failed is the 28-day medical model. Clearly, the literature says that in order for people to recover from addiction, there has to be long-term therapy. There's two problems to that. One is that there's nobody to provide it, but it also is that the insurance companies aren't covering it. They cover 20 visits. So the real concern is that this treatment for this epidemic has to be not only just the individual themselves, but it has to be the community that they live in, whether it be their family of origin or their family of choice. And everybody has to get on board with it so that the person can begin to live their life in a sober way.
So the 28-day medical model, not nearly enough, but that's what companies typically pay for? Is that what you're saying?
That's what companies had paid for until the 90s. And then they found out that the outcomes were so bad that they were no longer going to fund them, and they went to a medical necessity program. So the only way you could get treatment was you had to be in active withdrawal. What has happened is that the literature says that in order for somebody to stay clean and sober over time, they need long-term therapy. And you not only need to treat them, but you need to treat the culture, the community which they are living in, whether it be their family or the community itself.
Yeah, so it's
Again, that talks to, that costs money, who's going to provide the services, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'm so glad you called. And let's hit this right on the head. I mean, New Hampshire is often ranked as among the worst, maybe by some rankings, close to the bottom in terms of providing treatment. What do you think, Director Wolznack?
Well, I think the statistics are pretty clear on that. I think the only state that fares worse than us in terms of providing treatment or access to treatment for the population is Texas. But, you know, even on a good day, if you look at the state that has the highest degree of services available to this population, you still don't get above 10% of the people that need treatment. So this entire country has a shortage of treatment opportunities for people addicted. And the caller's absolutely right. You know, we've done a couple of things. In the 80s and the 90s, we had in the 90s, in this state, we had something on the order of 640-odd beds for residential treatment. In that era, we did treat everybody kind of with a one-size-fits-all. You go into a 28-day program and come out the other end.
But at least there was treatment.
At least there was treatment. Now there's less, you know, something around 10% of those beds available. So there's been like a 90% drop.
And why now, is that?
Well, primarily it's because insurance companies basically got tired of reimbursing for this sort of treatment. It simply fell out of favor. There could be a million reasons, but it doesn't matter what those reasons are.
Well, it's expensive.
Well, listen, everything is expensive. I mean, one of the things that happened around the time when substance use disorder treatment was curtailed by the insurance companies, we started doing organ transplants, which per patient are probably 10 times or 20 times more expensive than substance use treatment for an individual. So, you know, listen, healthcare is expensive no matter what. We're adding things all the time. We've got a new cholesterol drug, which potentially could cost $14,000 a year to lower somebody's cholesterol.
And so you're saying they're happy to pay for that, but not the drug
treatment. I for some reason it just fell out of favor. Other things took its place. Obviously, the expenses for healthcare in this country haven't gone down, right? They've gone up. But now we have to do something differently. So as a result of those changes, obviously the market for treatment basically went away. And we chased a lot of people who otherwise were qualified practitioners and therapists and counselors into other jobs because they simply couldn't make a living. So we have a workforce shortage.
Well, there's a ton to talk about there. So thank you, Karen, for calling. And we'll pick up that thread after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Jack Wozmak is here. He's New Hampshire's Senior Director of Substance Misuse and Behavioral Health for the Governor's Office, also known by most people as the state's drug czar. We're taking your questions and comments today about the heroin and opioid addiction crisis we're seeing in the Granite State, taking many lives, harming communities, businesses, families. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Director Wozmak, just before the break, we were talking about treatment or the lack thereof in this country and in the Granite State, and there's a lot more to talk about there. But go ahead and finish up with our caller's question or concern that private insurance companies have really dropped the ball here.
Yeah. For, again, whatever reason, the coverage for this sort of illness, chronic illness, just basically went away, got curtailed enough so that there was no longer the economic viability of the treatment centers needed to remain in operation. And you know, in most hospitals around the state, certainly many hospitals around the state, they used to have detox beds or psych beds. And you simply, without reimbursement, you simply can't support those services. And so we have done a good job decimating the entire treatment structure for substance use and behavioral health disorders. And so we have to rebuild that.
What are you talking to insurance companies about this? And I'll ask you in a couple of minutes, Director Wozmak, about, you know, the state's role and so forth, because there's a lot wrapped up there. But what about the private insurers? Are you talking to them about this?
I am. I've actually met with the president of Aetna and their two chief medical officers. I have a meeting. I've had several conversations with Harvard Pilgrim. I'll continue on with those meetings. One of the goals that I have with great support so far from them is to get them to adopt a uniform approach to reimbursement for coverage decisions so that the criteria are more transparent, the coverage is more clear, the expectations are more visible, and the ability to access treatment is easier. Well, those criteria are at the moment called the ASAM criteria, the American Society for Addiction Medicine. And there are some criteria that help identify on an individual basis what level of treatment and a person suffering from addiction might need. And it's, you know, it's not difficult, but it has some complexities to interview the patient and determine what level of care does he need. There are 7 or 8, maybe more, levels of care in the ASAM criteria. You know, the old days, this is kind of the reaction to the old days if everybody gets a 28-day program no matter what.
That's what our caller said, yeah.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. You know, I was the license administrator of Beech Hill Hospital back in the 80s, and that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, and we should let the audience know you have a background in this field.
I do. I've been involved in substance use treatment for almost 40 years now. Well, whatever. I started actually in Beech Hill in 1975, I would say, 74, 75, can't quite remember. That was the rule back then. The standards today are individual assessment based on an interaction and a dialogue with the patient about their background, their family history, the drugs that they've been using, the length of time they've been using, on and on and on. And that is intended to give you a more individualized assessment of the sort of treatment that you ought to have.
So we're tailoring things better to what people need,
right,
instead of saying, here's your 28 days, go.
That's right. So in my world, I'd like to see each hospital develop an assessment center. Now, I don't mean center in a big capital C sort of way, but people trained in using the ASAM criteria to do an assessment on somebody that's referred to them for an assessment of their disease.
So then they're assessed, but then it sounds like, from what I've read,
right,
there's nothing, very little available for them.
Well, I'll get to that. So if they're assessed correctly by the ASAM criteria, that will line up with coverage by insurance if everybody's using the same standard, which in many ways they are. More on that later. But so what needs to happen is a patient needs to know the level of care that he ought to have based on his history and the level of care that's appropriate for him. That will do that will go a long way towards lining up with insurance coverage, so you get fewer denials.
Aren't they supposed to cover substance abuse treatment under the Affordable Care Act? Isn't that one of the new rules?
It is, yes. And that's obviously one of the shifts that is bringing the pendulum back from, I'll say, no coverage to good coverage. And both of those terms are obviously very general for today's purposes. But you're right. The Affordable Care Act and parity laws in New Hampshire and across the country have increased the expectation that substance use disorders and behavioral health will receive will no longer receive less coverage than other medical diseases. But it has to be the right coverage, and that's where the alignment needs to take place with the assessments.
Instead of just throwing a standard
right
model at everybody. Let's
right
go back to our listeners. Director Wozmak, again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Walter is in Concord. Hi, Walter. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
Good. Listening to the program, I've seen and heard a lot about the heroin epidemic around the state. It's not just in the state of New Hampshire. It's all across the country. But because we're residents of the state, we tune in more. What people need to understand, and I myself, I've never experienced with any of it, thank God, have seen a lot of it throughout friends and stuff, a true education of what it is within the heroin that is making people so addicted to it. From what I understand, it's the fentanyl that they're making the heroin with. It's become one of the cheapest drugs around, very easy to get a hold of. I'm not able to get a hold of it because I'm really not interested in participating in it. However, the fentanyl is the addictive ingredient from what I understand. And if people don't understand, have an education on how to beat that addiction, or if they don't want to get help for the addiction, then we're just going to continue on with the epidemic.
Well, Walter, Narcan, yeah. Thank you for
calling. Narcan does bring people back, but after a while, the body is going to become immune to that as well. And that every time they do experiment with the drug, they're just getting, they want more and more. And it's part of the addictive personality. So thank you for your time.
You know, Walter, I'm really glad you called. Two important points he raises. One is fentanyl, and we haven't talked about that yet. Now, for those who don't know what that is, Director Wozmak, can you just tell us?
Well, fentanyl is another narcotic. The fentanyl that he's referring to that appears in varying percentages in the heroin on the street isn't the sort of – it isn't your grandmother's fentanyl. It's not produced by drug companies. It's produced in these makeshift labs either around the country or down to Mexico or South America, and then it finds its way up. It is profoundly more potent than heroin, and consequently – it does carry a much higher likelihood of producing an overdose for someone who takes it in and doesn't realize that either the strength of it or the composition of the heroin that he's shooting. It isn't necessarily that it's more addictive than heroin.
It's more powerful, so the risk of overdose is greater.
It is more powerful. You know, we could probably spend an entire hour on the brain's response in terms of the opioid receptors, in terms of how the brain responds to the presence of drugs, and the neurological and biochemical reactions in there. But clearly, the more you use drugs, the more that the brain wants to limit receptors in the brain because there's too much dopamine that's getting bounced around. And so it's a complicated chemical interaction in the brain. But fentanyl's not necessarily more addictive. People do appreciate the fact, apparently, that it gives you a different high. Could be more intense if it doesn't kill you.
And it's deadly.
So it's deadly. And you can never really know how much fentanyl is in the heroin that you're buying. Some people kind of use a very, very rough gauge in terms of the color and that sort of thing. But
well, he also mentioned Narcan, and we should talk about that.
Yeah.
That is the overdose revival drug, if I could call it that. And
right.
Part of what your office has been doing, Director Wozmak, is getting Narcan out more broadly to more people.
Right. Yes. What Narcan does, you have to understand, you get these little receptors on the brain. They're like little pods. And the drugs that go in, they attach to those receptors, and that's what produces the high. It also is what produces the overdose when too many receptors take in too much of the drug. So Narcan, once it's administered, kind of puts a little umbrella around the receptor so that the drug can't access the receptor in the brain. The problem with Narcan, if there is a problem, is obviously it does reverse some overdoses. But it is a function of the drugs that they're on, how much. We need to certainly get more Narcan available. That is a process that involves the training of literally thousands of people.
Yeah, not just EMTs or other health
not
professionals,
just EMTs,
but family members and so forth.
We're in the process of getting out educational materials to nurse practitioners, to physicians, to pharmacists, developing educational materials so that when an individual picks up Narcan at a pharmacy, they can undertake some training so they can know how to administer it. That takes about 15 minutes. Listen, there are adverse side effects to Narcan. There are people who do not react well to it and have to be hospitalized because
of
the
Narcan.
Is it like an
EpiPen for an overdose?
Well, there is a method out there which is much more expensive, $400 or $500, which is the equivalent of an EpiPen, and it talks you through it. There's another one that's just an injectable that you would stick into your leg, I think. And then there's the nasal atomizer, which is the most, I'll say, consumer-friendly one, that you just spritz it into the nasal passage. But it still takes some training to administer it correctly if you're going to have the intended effect.
Well, and as amazing as it is, and we've heard, you know, stories about loved ones literally being, you know, pulled from death's door.
Right.
Is there an element, Director Wozmak, of, you know, deeply addicted folks saying, hey, my mom's got Narcan, so let's go.
Yeah. The issue with Narcan is it is not a panacea. It will not save everybody.
But does that message get through?
Well, that's part of the material that we're producing and trying to disseminate through physicians and doctors' offices and waiting rooms and pharmacies and education. You know, the Narcan will certainly help, and it'll bring you back. But the first thing you should do is call 911, because Narcan is going to temporarily overcome the effect of the drug on the brain. But it is only temporary, and it could last a few minutes or it could last 20 minutes. And you don't know how long it's going to last because there's no way to know the strength of the drug that the person's ingested. And so the effectiveness of the Narcan go away very quickly. And so this concept that you might deliver Narcan to somebody and then walk away and everything is fine is misguided.
Here's an email that just came in from Jean, who says, it is important to note that both managed care companies contracted by New Hampshire Medicaid do not cover detox from anything. Jean says, since the vast majority of people seeking treatment are on Medicaid, they have little access to treatment. State-funded beds are few and far between. Okay, so we talked a lot about private insurance companies, but what about those folks who are on Medicaid?
Medicaid, actually, as of today, does cover detox. And, you know, as with all Medicaid rates, it isn't the highest reimbursement that you can imagine. It probably consistently approaches 50% of a person's cost. So, for example, if I send somebody over to Farnham Center in Manchester, which is an exemplary detox facility is pretty much full all the time because of the demand. Medicaid will reimburse them something on the order of $250 to $300 for detox.
So you're covered on paper, but finding that treatment.
Finding the treatment is difficult because you have to have a mix of economic viability within a facility. Easter Seals is a bit unique because it is supported by donations in large measure, and so they can make up that difference and they can have a lot of Medicaid people in there. In a very nice facility. So there is, and this is as Medicaid expansion has rolled out you will see Medicaid reimbursement for detox. So while I'll say yesterday what the emailer says was true, today it is not true.
Well, so but Medicaid
still,
is covered.
Medicaid will cover detox. But the issue is, how much does it cover? You have to then find a facility that's willing to do the detox. They have to find
a
facility
low Medicaid rate.
That's right. You have to find a facility that's not only has the skill to detox you, which is a problem that we're working on, but also the willingness and the financial strength to do it at basically half of their cost.
So this gets hung up partly, right, Director Wozniak, in the budget impasse. Governor Hassan vetoed the Republican budget. Both of those budgets did increase substance abuse funding. How does that leave what you're trying to do and all the folks who are seeking treatment, especially state-funded treatment? How does this impasse leave them?
From my view at the moment, the budget impasse hasn't really had an impact. The work that I'm doing is taking place. It isn't necessarily connected to the budget. The dollars that are available at the Bureau of Drug and Alcohol Services to provide this are there. We actually, because we've got this other issue where there's not an adequate capacity of treatment, we cannot receive for treatment all the people who want treatment.
So the expansion is being harmed.
Yeah, sure. So we have the money to pay for the treatment that is presently before us, and the budget's going to resolve itself, you know, probably before the end of the year. I certainly would hope so. But I don't see a direct impediment with respect to that at the moment. We've got some capacity issues, which is to say we need to increase the number of people who are willing to come into the state or expand in the state to provide treatment.
That workforce issue that you talked about earlier.
Well, it's the workforce, because if I get a treatment provider to come in and set up a treatment center, they're going to have to hire employees like counselors and therapists and nurses and doctors who are educated about substance use disorders. That's a tall order. And we're in the process not only of finding people to come in and provide treatment, but we're also in the process of developing increased numbers of clinicians and counselors who would work there.
So you can set up shop, but then you have to find people to run that shop, and
that's correct.
Difficult.
That's its own hurdle.
So is that first order of business? You had 22 or 21 recommendations recently. Is that first?
You know, at some level, every single one of them is happening concurrently because they have to.
All right. I think we have a lot more to talk about, but we've got to stop there.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Jack Wozmak. Again, he's the state's drug czar or the senior director of substance misuse and behavioral health. This is The Exchange on NHPR.